All right. We're doing it. We're live. Here we go. Hi. What's up, YouTube? We're on TikTok as well. Got TikTok over here. Just out of the shot. They're right here. They're right here. You can't see them, but they can see me and they can't see you. But hi, everybody. How's it going? Hi, Spotify. Spotify, you can't see anybody. Apple Podcasts, you can't see anybody. If you're driving, watch the road. Keep your eyes on the road. Don't be looking for TikTok or YouTube. That would be ridiculous. That would be a bad idea. How's it going? I got that song in my head. I've been singing it all day. If I were a fish and you caught me, I'd say, look at that fish. Shimmering in the sun, such a rare one. Can't believe that you caught one. It's fun, dude. It's cute. It's happy. It's fun. They're having a good time. I'm so glad a song like that goes viral. It just tells all the capitalist fat cats at the studios, the record labels, like, you know what? Sometimes we just want that, okay? All right, chill. Body Shop look, I love Sam Smith, all right? Love me some Sam Smith, okay? But sometimes I'm like, chill, all right? With all the production, with all the fancy schmancy bells and whistles. Sometimes we just want, if I were a fish and you caught me, sitting on the floor cross-legged, crisscross applesauce style, chugging along on a guitar. My favorite version that I saw is some bluesgrass musicians jumped in, and there was like one guy on like a ukulele, or not a ukulele, sorry, a banjo, picking along on a banjo. And then another guy got in on the fiddle. And it was like the perfect for that. I didn't think of that song as like a little bluesgrass, like Appalachia, you know, folk tune. But then hearing those instruments on top of it, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, that's what it is. That's the great thing about a viral song on the internet, is watching it evolve, watching strangers jump in and add a line or two, add some harmony, add some extra instruments. It's great. It's great. Everyone's making fun of me right now on TikTok for saying bluesgrass, bluegrass, blue cheese, blue balls. everyone can lick my blues ass, all right? Everyone on TikTok that's making fun of me for saying bluesgrass can lick my blues ass. So that's that. Hi, how's it going? Let's get into the show. There's a lot of show to cover. We're going to start off at the top here with a little bit of Bad Take Brigade. Okay, just a little bit, because it's going to lead directly into what we're talking about on the show this week. We're going to look at Matt Walsh. Always good for a bad take. You always know you can count on Matt Walsh on any given day on Twitter, on the internet, with a bad take. The boy is a chef when it comes to cooking up the worst takes humanity has to offer. So Matt Walsh tweeted out this video that kind of went viral, especially amongst conservatives, and no wonder it went viral. There's this video of a bunch of black teenagers attacking a white woman and beating her up, and like kind of a mob. And it's pretty disturbing video to watch. I don't know all the context of the video, of like what started the altercation, what caused the violence. You know, that's the thing that conservatives and white supremacists always like to ask whenever there's a video of a black teenager or a black person being viciously attacked or brutalized. They're always like, I need to see the whole video. Show me more context. What happened before this video? What happened before the cop curb stomped that guy into the curb who was begging for his life? What did he say before this? I need to see the full video for context. And so, like, I don't know the full context of this video, but even without knowing the full context, I'll say that, like, it's not a fun video to watch. It's disturbing. I never really like videos of like extreme violence being perpetrated on somebody. Even sometimes, I'll say this, like, fuck Richard Spencer, but even that video of him like getting sucker punched in the jaw, and I'm like, I do not think that like I'm not here to defend Richard Spencer or say that he doesn't deserve to be punched in the jaw, but my visceral gut reaction to watching someone get socked like that is just like, I don't like it. But fuck Richard Spencer, and like, I'm totally okay with him getting socked in the jaw. That's totally fine with me. And Richard Spencer has done more than enough in his life to earn being socked in the jaw like that. But it's just videos like this always sort of make me like, oh man, I wish there was a different way through that issue. Anyway, that's not the point. I don't really know the context of the video, but conservatives were tweeting out this video of these black teenagers attacking this white woman. This is Matt Walsh's take on the video. Matt Walsh wrote on Twitter, "White woman viciously attacked by a group of black teens. You absolutely never see videos like this with the races reversed." Never. Doesn't exist. At some point, we need to discuss why this kind of violence literally, the word literally, that's in there, literally always goes one way. I'm going to read this tweet one more time. I'm going to read it one more time to let this sink in. White woman viciously attacked by a group of black teens. You absolutely, listen to all the words here, the declarative, no gray area words that are used in this tweet. You absolutely, he writes, this is unequivocally, absolutely, totally, all encompassing. You absolutely never, not ever, never see videos like this with the races reversed. Again, he says, never, period. So he says, you absolutely never see videos like this with the races reversed. Never. Doesn't exist. At some point, we need to discuss why this kind of violence literally always goes one way. I read this tweet and I was genuinely flabbergasted. I was genuinely like, I mean, I read bad takes from Matt Walsh and Ben Shapiro and Marjorie Taylor Greene and their ilk every day on the internet because I am a glutton for punishment and I am on Twitter. And so I see them every single day. And this one really took my breath away. The definitiveness of it, the certainty of it, that you never, not just, we so rarely see videos where the races are reversed. It's most the time it's this way. We need to have a conversation about why most the time we see videos like this, it's black people attacking a white person and not the other way around. No, it's never. It's literally always that the violence literally always is from black people to white people and not the other direction. That it's literally always so this ties into this notion of every time a conservative person makes an accusation, it's a confession, right? That conservative ideology is sort of built on projection. That like so many aspects of what conservatives believe and what they preach and what they talk about are they'll say things that they're against, and they'll literally be describing themselves, and they'll say things like, you know, like, well, we're the party that's trying to root out pedophilia. We're concerned about children being preyed upon, and we're concerned about kids. When literally, like, the biggest perpetrators of child sexual abuse that we know of, just statistically, like in America, is like churches and clergy members, like Christians, conservative religious groups. And then we also know that, like, the Republican Party just like has way more people with credible sexual assault and pedophilia accusations in their party than the Democratic Party does. So it's like, these kind of things where every time that, you know, conservatives will talk about how the media lies and how you can't trust the news and how, you know, fake news and the news is, and they'll kind of say it unequivocally. They won't just say like, don't trust MSNBC, don't trust CNN. They'll just say like, the news lies. When like Fox News just lost a multi-billion dollar lawsuit, or what did it come up out to a billion, or was it like 787 million? I can't remember what the final number was. It was very big. It was a very large number that they had to pay for getting caught lying, just lying all the time about the 2020 election being stolen, and just lying about Dominion and their voting machines and text messages of them knowing that they're liars. So conservatives, you know, talking about the media lies to you, when it's like literally your outlets are built on bold-faced lies, just like lying through your teeth all the time and knowingly lying. And so another big thing that conservatives say all the time, that's a new thing that, you know, Elon Musk has tweeted about this, and it's sort of this popular new thing, is that being woke, being progressive, is a mind virus that corrupts your view of reality. So it's a virus that infects the mind and makes you see the world through a warped lens. And this Matt Walsh tweet is the greatest example that I can find right now. Well, there, I could find so many, but this is such a succinct example of how that accusation of, you know, the woke mind virus, progressivism is a mind virus, that like, again, the accusation is a confession. Conservatism is literally a mind virus that is corrupting the way these people see reality. Because there's two possibilities here with this Matt Walsh tweet. Either he's doing the thing that we know Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham have done, where he's just like lying and he knows he's lying and he's just doing it because like that's just his brand, and he's just gotten so used to lying to his base that like he just sort of does it like breathing. He doesn't really think about it anymore. Or he's gotten – and I kind of think the second one is more likely with a guy like Matt Walsh. He's so – down the spiral of his own bullshit and conservative ideology that his brain has literally been warped to think that what he's saying is accurate. That he actually tweets this out with a confidence, that he actually steps into a sociopolitical discourse on violent intra-racial violence with the confidence to say, it literally never happens that white people perpetrate extreme violence on black people and on people of color. It literally never happens. It doesn't exist, he wrote. He wrote the words doesn't exist and never and literally always happens only one way. I can't conceive of that level of delusional thinking. And this goes back to my, you know, We're Not the Same series, where I've asked people repeatedly to say, like, if you're a centrist who believes that there are extremists on both sides and that both sides are reactionary and that both sides are spreading misleading information and that both sides are guilty of contributing to the divisiveness in the country, like, what I usually say is, like, that's fine. You just got to prove it. You just got to show me the evidence. You got to show me the left equivalent of QAnon. You've got to show me what on the left is equivalent to people thinking that JFK Jr. was going to be Trump's running mate. You've got to show me the evidence. So the equivalent, not something similar, but the equivalent of what Matt Walsh would say is, if I came out, so let's say, you know, Ralph Jarl was just a black teenage boy who just rung the wrong doorbell recently, was just shot in the head, and because he just was in the wrong neighborhood, rung the wrong doorbell. So right off the bat, like, it's not hard for me to find just one example of Matt Walsh being 100% wrong here, that it definitely is not always one way. Let's say that video happens, or that situation happens, Jarl happens, and I come out on the internet and I say, it literally never happens the other way. There are no examples of people of color perpetrating violence on white people. It doesn't exist. It only ever happens that white people perpetrate violence on people of color. It never happens the other way. That's the same level of intellectual dishonesty I would need to have to match Matt Walsh in that space of both sides are just as unhinged. And it's unfathomable to make a claim like that and expect to be taken seriously. I can't conceive of it. And the weird thing is again, I think Matt Walsh believes his bullshit. I think that he confidently steps up to the plate and says, we got to have a conversation about why this kind of violence literally only ever goes one way. We got to have that conversation. And he does that because his brain has been rotted. He has lost the plot on reality. Somebody commented in the comments on YouTube, 787.5 million settlement. So that's right. Okay. Just under a billion that Fox had to pay for lying. But and it is weird because maybe he is knowingly lying the same way that the Fox News anchors are knowingly lying, the same way that like Rupert Murdoch was like, yeah, they lie. Like, I know that they lie. Like, you know, like everyone in that lawsuit was like, no, we're liars for sure. Like, that's what we do. And maybe that is Matt Walsh's. But this one's just such a like insanely obvious lie. Like, he was just like, there's never any videos of violence like this going the other way. And it was like, dude, where, like, no, there are hundreds of videos of police officers ganging up on unarmed black people and, like, brutalizing them and murdering them. Like, we're just inundated with these videos. There are, like, this country, America, is built on the back of white-on-black violence. It's built, this country foundationally is literally built on violence being perpetrated from white people to black people. Like it is foundationally baked into the DNA of this country. I can't imagine saying something that disingenuous and actually expecting anyone to take me seriously, no matter how big of a fan of me they are. And this is that level of delusion where I'm like, you're not living in the same objective reality as us. If you can seriously make that claim, if you can actually make that claim and be like, no, seriously, I genuinely think that this never happens the other way. It only ever happens one way. It's like, well, then you're not living in the same reality. Then you're not living in the same reality. Sarah on YouTube says their response to you would be, well, we are talking about this exact circumstance, a defenseless woman being attacked unprovoked. Again, don't know the full context of that video. I haven't learned the full context of that video. That's what they would say is we need to, but like, yeah, that exact situation does exist all the time. And it has existed throughout America's history. And in much greater numbers, it has existed going from white people to black people. Like I mentioned in my the tweet that I responded to Matt, I responded to Matt Walsh, and I was like, I said something to the effect of like, there are hundreds of videos of police officers ganging up on unarmed black people who didn't do anything wrong and beating them within an inch of their life or just killing them. There are probably photos of Matt Walsh's grandparents smiling at a lynching like they're at a neighborhood barbecue. And I said something to that effect, and somebody in the comments was like, well, you know, lynchings haven't existed for 100 years. And it's like, well, that's just not true either. That's not true. Lynchings still happen. They still exist. Ahmaud Arbery was minding his own business and was just on a jog through a neighborhood, and a bunch of white men in a truck lynched him. That's what happened. They rolled up and said, let's get this guy who's minding his own business, and they lynched him. So, yeah, like, it's just insane. And what's really at the core of what is corrosive to Matt Walsh's perception of reality is white supremacy. Is the infection, the mind virus. Again, they're talking about the woke mind virus, and I'm like, no, what the mind virus is white supremacy. The mind virus is this idea that allegiance to a group of people based on the amount of melanin in their skin is what sensible people need to do, is to group up based on the amount of melanin you have in your skin. And we need to make sure that people with a similar amount of melanin to me are in charge, and people with more melanin than me are not in charge. And that's wild. It is a virus. It's an infection in your mind that is distorting your view of reality. And it's so this is what I actually want to talk about is bigotry, because it's such an unnatural and obviously illogical concept to hate someone and to wish for the oppression of someone and to wish to have dominion over someone based on immutable facts about their identity. It feels so obvious that that is wrong. It feels intuitively obvious that seeking to oppress or dominate or oppose a person or a group of people based on just simple immutable facts of their identity is not good and is bad. And yet, it is this really pervasive problem that we have in our species. And it's been pervasive for a very, very, very long time. So it's got me asking this question of like, where does this come from? Why is this a part of the story of our species? Where does this originate? What causes this? The other big thing that got me asking this question was Natalie Wynn finally released her newest video. You know, we always wait on pins and needles for the latest ContraPoints video because it takes her forever to make them because she makes movies. You know, she's making these like cinematic video essays that understandably take a while, but she released her latest video and it's fantastic. If you haven't seen it yet, go, if you're not subscribed to ContraPoints on YouTube, you should be, and you should watch all of her videos. You should watch her first video that she did about J.K. Rowling, and you should watch this most recent one where she breaks down, you know, the witch trials of J.K. Rowling. And she really gets into the psychology of bigotry and the psychology of what's going on with people who are finding themselves in sort of what she calls a bigot vortex. Like, how does people who get sucked into a bigotry vortex, and then the deeper and deeper they get into it, the harder it is to get them out. And she really kind of dissects like what might be happening in their psyche. And it really just got me thinking while I was watching it, like, what is happening to a person like J.K. Rowling who has every reason to not be a bigot? You know, who like has been very successful and is a very creative person and a very intelligent person, seemingly, and a very reasonable person, you would think, and a person who got famous writing stories about identity and about literally the central allegory of her most famous work, the work that was going to solidify her as a legend. And she's currently destroying her legacy. She is currently just taking a sledgehammer to her legacy with every passing day that she refuses to shift her stance on trans people. But the central allegory of her most famous work, the work that she's going to be remembered for, is like this kid who's raised in a literal closet, who is rejected by the family that raises him, who is hated by the family that raises him because of his identity, because of just the nature of his birth, and who discovers the truth about his identity, and it sets him free. And he discovers that the truth about his identity, even though his family, the people who are raising him, hate him for it, is beautiful. He discovers that the truth about who he is and who he was born to be is a really beautiful thing and really powerful thing. And embracing his identity, even though it goes against what the culture and society that he was raised in wants, and even though it goes against what the family that raised him wants, is a really powerful and self-actualizing thing for him. And like, it's so weird that a person who crafted that narrative and crafted that story is decimating her legacy in favor of these really bigoted ideas that she refuses to part with. She refuses to acknowledge are problematic. And it's a really bizarre thing to watch, because it's like, well, it's not like there's a lack of educational opportunity for her. It's not like there's a lack of opportunity for her to speak with and understand trans and non-binary people. It's not like it really had me asking the question, like, where does this come from? And, you know, I think I've talked about on other episodes of this podcast about, like, what makes bigotry hard to get out of. And I've talked about this with J.K. Rowling in particular. And Natalie on ContraPoints talked about this idea of this bigot vortex, this kind of cyclone that sucks you deeper and deeper the longer you stay in it. And the longer you stay committed to that argument, the harder it is to pull yourself out of that vortex. And that can be really hard for some people, because the deeper that you go in, the more you dig your heels in on, no, I don't think that that person is a valid kind of person. No, I don't think that we should be affording certain rights and liberties and respects and dignities to that kind of person. The more that you publicly dig your heels in on that, the more vitriolic that you allow yourself to be publicly, the harder it becomes to get honest with yourself and with others about the damage that you are doing. And that's understandable. There's a self-preservation in that. There's a psychological self-preservation happening where you're like, if I were to suddenly one day get honest, because you can almost bet that there are like probably some times where Joanne Rowling reads, you know, like comments or messages that are written to her from trans people who used to be big fans of hers, who are like, hey, you really broke my heart. Like, Harry Potter was like the most special thing in the world to me. And like, it really broke my heart to find out that like, you don't think that I'm a valid kind of human being. And there are probably moments where she questions herself, where she goes, geez, am I doing something wrong here? And what happens, I'm guessing, is this sort of psychological self-preservation kicks in, this self-defense kicks in, where it's like, if I allow myself to go down that rabbit hole, I'm going to have to reckon with what that means, which is, I've not just hurt this person, I've hurt millions of people, I've really hurt many, many, many people, and I've actually been wrong about something that it's really bad to be wrong about, and I've actually been doing serious harm. I've taken a legacy that could have been about standing up for marginalized identities, and I've turned it into one of hatred and exclusion and fear, and that's a really hard thing for an ego to suffer. That's a really hard blow for any person to come to terms with. And so I think that there is a little bit of like psychological self-preservation where you cannot allow yourself to accept that the harm that you may have done. I think that's sort of the space that Matt Walsh lives in. I think that's sort of the space that Ben Shapiro lives in, is sort of this sunk cost space where it's like, I've invested too much. I've invested too much into harmful narratives to turn around and say, you know what? I might have been wrong about that stuff. And so in order to preserve the way that they feel about themselves, just their relationship with themselves and the way that they think about who they are and the kind of person and what they bring into the world, they're forced to constantly be looking for arguments that can support their bigotry. They're forced to that's why they always have to resort to bad faith arguments too. And to like, that's why like Matt Walsh will literally, he's so deep in the bigotry vortex that he will convince himself that there is no such thing as white on black violence in order to justify where he is, to justify how deep he sunk into that vortex. Because if he looks at that clip and he goes, you know what, I mean, intraracial violence happens both ways and this is bad, but it also, like, I get it, like, black people have been the victims of like systemic violence for hundreds of years, and so like it's a tough situation. If he does that, then everything that he's done with his life starts to unravel. And he has to start getting real with all of the pain and all of the harm that he's caused people over the years. And he can't do that, so he starts to just craft increasingly more and more illogical and disingenuous and bad faith arguments. And he starts to actually believe those arguments as a means of psychological self-preservation. And I think that that's happening with that's what's happening with J.K. Rowling is – there's a little bit of like what happens to people when they become extremely wealthy, just sort of the antisocial aspect of that and like how that isolates people from society and how that isolates people from, the common person and what that does psychologically to a person. There's definitely that playing into it, but there's also this aspect of like she cannot psychologically go to the place where she might be wrong about this. Because it would be devastating for her if she did. And she cannot psychologically bear that weight. I think another thing that happens, and we're all susceptible to this. We're all susceptible to these pitfalls. And that's why I think it's important to talk about this. I think another thing that happens is we have a tendency to view ourselves – No matter what our opinion on ourselves is, even if we are very self-critical people, and even if we would say like I hate myself sometimes, we have a tendency to still paint ourselves narratively as the hero in our own story. We are still the protagonist of our own story. Fundamentally, whether we're a good person or a bad person or a person who does a little bit of both or whatever however we feel about ourselves, we still narratively see ourselves as the protagonist. And so what happens sometimes when we're experiencing backlash for certain views or opinions or beliefs that we hold is we get stuck in a narrative where we are now heroically trudging against the yoke of persecution. So, you know, the people shouting us down becomes a story of heroic defiance in the face of oppression and persecution. So we start to kind of attach our identity to a hero narrative that's really a victim narrative. But it's like J.K. Rowling starts seeing herself as like a Rosa Parks. She starts seeing herself as a person who's like heroically, bravely sacrificing her own safety and her own good image and good name for a righteous cause. And I think Matt Walsh does this too. Matt Walsh recently tweeted about how like, and these people love it. They love painting themselves as victims. They love, he talked about how like his YouTube channel got demonetized recently and how his family gets threats and things like that. Natalie Wynn in this video about J.K. Rowling, talks about how much J.K. Rowling and people who defend her, Posey Parker and all of these, Posey Parker, two different people, Posey Parker love to talk about the vitriolic and mean things that trans activists say to them and about them, the mean DMs they get, the comments they get, the things that people put on signs at protests. And these things help bolster this thing that's going on narratively in their head where they're like, well, if I'm the protagonist of the story and all of these people are being really vitriolic about pushing against something that I've said or something that I've done, then like I must be in my Martin Luther King era. I must be living through, you know, this is what happened to Jesus Christ. Like this is what happens to great people who speak important truths, is the mob often comes for them with torches and with tar and feathers. And this is what's happening to me. And so that also fuels the fire of going deeper into the vortex and having a harder time detaching from it, because that there's sort of an intoxicant in that. That's sort of an intoxicant for the ego. This idea that I'm not just the protagonist, I'm not just the hero, but I'm now a persecuted hero, which is one of the greatest kinds of heroes there can be. A hero that is fighting a righteous fight against a very vocal, very vitriolic mob of persecution and oppression. And I mean, it's like I saw this tweet the other day from Mike Lee, a senator from Utah, who was tweeting about Dylan Mulvaney. You know, Dylan Mulvaney's been in the news for a martyr. Yeah, Sarah says on YouTube, a martyr. Exactly, a martyr. And Mike Lee tweeted about Dylan Mulvaney because Dylan Mulvaney started her career in the Book of Mormon musical. She was in the Book of Mormon musical. And Mike Lee was like, oh yeah, you know, Bud Light, what a great way to show inclusion and acceptance and inclusivity by choosing a sponsor who started her career. Only I don't think he said her. I think he used the wrong pronouns, but because of course he did. But he was like, who started her career by mercilessly ridiculing the beliefs of a religious minority. So this is Mike Lee trying to take back the narrative and say, like, no, Dylan Mulvaney is actually the bigot. Dylan Mulvaney started her career by mercilessly ridiculing this preyed upon religious minority that is the LDS church. And it was so funny to me to see, as a person who's from Utah, because I was like, man, these people really do want to be the victims so bad. They want to be martyrs so bad. But the difference, of course, between the trans community that Dylan Mulvaney is a part of, and that Dylan Mulvaney is sort of a public-facing representative of, not that Dylan Mulvaney is the spokesperson for trans people or that Dylan Mulvaney is like the chosen leader of trans people, but just that Dylan Mulvaney is a public-facing member of the community and a public-facing kind of representative of the community. But like, the difference between that community and the LDS Church is that the LDS Church is a trillion-dollar international organization that owns their own state. They literally have their own – they have a state, dude. Trans people don't own a state. Trans people don't have an organization amongst them that is worth over $1 trillion with just – hundreds of billions of dollars stockpiled in different safes, safe houses and banks all over the world. The LDS Church has that. The LDS Church has mainstream real political power, real wealth, and real, like I said, they own one of the 50 United States. They own one. They have their own state. They own it. they're like, no, Utah, that's ours. And like Idaho too, kind of. And like kind of Arizona, but like Utah for sure, that's ours. Like you come in there, you're in our state. That's our place. So it's so funny to be like, Dylan Mulvaney started their career by ridiculing this religious minority. It's like, yeah, you're not talking about a group that needs protection societally. You're not talking about a group that like people are writing legislation to try to legislate them out of existence. No one is proposing legislation right now to try to make it so that Mormons don't exist, to make it so that the LDS Church doesn't exist. That's not a thing. But people are vocally trying to make sure that trans people can no longer exist. People are vocally trying to legislate trans people out of existence. That's the big difference here, you know, between those two things. But all we're talking about so far is why it's hard for people to pull themselves out of the bigot spiral, the bigot vortex, you know, these kind of psychological safeguards that come up where it's like just the deeper you go in, the harder it is to admit to yourself the harm that you may have done. Also, you get caught up in the high of this persecuted hero narrative, this martyr narrative, the social currency of victimhood, stuff like that. But like that still doesn't answer the question of where does the bigotry come from in the first place? Where do such antisocial and inhumane beliefs originate from? Like, what is the actual source position for this? How does it start? And I don't know. I've been thinking about this, and like, again, Natalie's got so much great stuff in her video that you should go watch on it, that she breaks down, you know, where it might come from. And I'm definitely borrowing from this video, but like, there are different things that I think that there's, you know, something maybe evolutionary about that generational, some kind of generational DNA coding that comes in with survival and tribalism and fear of the other, that like people at some point in history had to try to cling close to their tribe for survival. That's what survival meant. And when someone came in who had other customs and a different look and a different energy and different beliefs from your own, it meant a potential threat to your well-being and to your survival. And maybe some of that carries over. I don't know. I'm not sure how much of that we could actually chart, but like maybe some of that is baked in there. There's a really interesting point that Natalie makes in her video about projection of personal trauma that I thought was really fascinating. She sets up this comparison with J.K. Rowling to Anita Bryant, who is another very famous anti-queer bigot. Anita Bryant was like sort of the OG J.K. Rowling. Anita Bryant was this, if you don't know, was this kind of famous woman in the 70s who was famous for doing these orange juice commercials, and she was like an ex-beauty pageant winner. And she became really famous when she sort of got a platform for speaking out against gay people and just feeling like gay people shouldn't be a part of civilized society. And it's sort of like, you know, when someone like Candace Owens, who's like been around trying to do stuff, finally finds more of a platform by just being a bigot. That's another thing that I think creates that sucks people into the bigot vortex, is like maybe you have some like fringe bigot beliefs, but you're sort of like I sort of dip a toe into them from time to time, but you're a person who seeks public spot the public spotlight and a stage at any cost, and like kind of how Candace Owens was. And then like the moment that you're willing to just be full chested about bigotry and to like promote bigoted ideas, you start seeing more spotlight and more stage time. And then you're like, okay, well, that's what I want. Even if it means people are mad at me about it, attention is attention. No such thing as bad press. And I think, you know, Anita Bryant got really into the persecution narrative, that people were like being really harsh to her, that she lost her sponsorship with Florida Orange Juice. But like, arguably, she had never been on a bigger stage than when she started speaking out about her feelings on gay people. And it gave her the biggest spotlight she'd ever had. And she definitely didn't slow down because of the backlash to it. She just ramped it up for her whole life. I think she's still alive, and she's still like, when people interview her, is like, she's like, no, I'm right. Gay people are bad, and I'm right about that. And I'll go to my grave saying it. And it's the thing that sort of came to define her. And it's the thing that sort of came to define her as a public figure. But there are so many parallels between Anita's story and J.K. Rowling's story. And this element of projecting personal trauma as a means to, as a sort of a conduit to developing bigoted beliefs, was really, really interesting. That Anita Bryant spoke several times about feeling sort of rejected by her father, and sort of having a contemptuous relationship with her father, one where she felt like she wasn't accepted, and one where she felt like she never really got her father's love in the way that she wanted it. And she hypothesized and speculated that that's what caused homosexuality in men, particularly, is a rejection from their father. And then they sought out acceptance from basically, you know, like father proxies by having romantic relationships with men. They sought out acceptance from other men in homosexuality. And this is a pretty common belief from people who are, you know, bigots toward gay people, is that like being gay comes from either like too much affection from your mother or not enough affection from the father. And Anita Bryant definitely helped to popularize this idea. But all Anita Bryant was really doing was projecting her own experience and her own trauma onto the people that she hated. So her actual beef was with her dad. Her actual beef was with like some straight cisgender dude who like was a bad father and who treated her poorly. And she took that pain and that frustration, and she projected it onto this group of marginalized people who already had enough problems of their own without her jumping into the mix. But she took that and she said, maybe they're gay. Maybe they are the way they are because they also experienced something similar to what I experienced. Maybe their dads were also mean to them. And she sort of saw that as a compassionate view that she had. So in many interviews, she'd be like, hey, no, I don't hate gay people. This is another thing that Anita Bryant and J.K. Rowling do is they, and I think Matt Walsh does it to a certain degree, is like they convince themselves that it's not about hate. I don't hate anybody. I don't hate them. I at all. I actually feel a lot of empathy that like these people probably experienced the same kind of rejection from their father that I did, but that's not an excuse to go and sin against God, which is another place that I think bigotry originates from, is God and religion. But we'll get to there. I want to talk about this idea of projection, of personal trauma, a little bit more first. Joanne Rowling has the same thing. She wrote a whole essay about her gender critical beliefs when it comes to trans and non-binary people, and she wrote about how her father never really cared for her in the way that she wished he had, and she always felt like her father wished he had had a son. And she talks about how if she had grown up in a time when being trans was maybe more socially accepted, maybe she would have sought out that route. Maybe she would have called herself trans in order to earn the approval of her father. So again, she's projecting her own personal trauma onto all these other people. You know, it's like she's not listening to trans people. Anita Bryant's not listening to gay people. There are plenty of gay people who have a great relationship with both parents, who are like, I had two very loving parents who were very supportive of me, and I'm just gay. It's just how I am. And there are just plenty of trans people who are like, no, me and my parents get along just fine. And I got a great, like, my parents were, when I told them I was trans, they were like, hey, whatever, you know, we had a daughter, now we have a son, that's great. So this whole theory that it originates from some kind of rejection from a parent, it just doesn't hold water when you actually go and listen to trans people. But that's not what J.K. Rowling's doing. That's not what Anita Bryant did. What they're doing is projecting their own story onto these people and trying to think, why is that person doing that thing? Why are they acting in that unnatural way? And this is what's sort of uniquely difficult about deprogramming bigotry toward queer people, is that it's easier for the bigots to convince themselves that being gay, being bisexual, being pansexual, being trans, being non-binary, that these are not actually real things, that these are not actually real aspects of identity worthy of respect, that they are actually aspects of some kind of mental illness brought on by some kind of trauma. So they're not real. So these people, when you say like, how do you not see that it's wrong that you're rejecting people based on immutable aspects of their identity? They're like, well, I don't believe that these aspects of their identity are immutable facts. I believe that they are aberrations of their identity brought on by some sort of abnormal trauma, that they're not just... So it's harder to deprogram, but then it's like, again, bigotry still exists for people who are just like, I don't like black people. And it's like, well, you can't really say that that's the result of trauma. You can't really say that someone being born in Mexico is the result of trauma. And you're like, yeah, I mean, they don't have to be Mexican. It's like, yeah, the fuck they do. They can't not be, you know, but people are still bigoted toward people for being born in Mexico. Like, that's still just a thing that exists. So like, but it does get more difficult when it comes to queer people, because people will be like, oh no, I'm not, you know, Joanne Rowling can tell herself, I'm not a bigot. I don't hate anybody based on just how they were born. I just don't think that trans people were born that way. I think that they're, and she, her real problem is like trans women specifically. She has this problem with men because of the way that she was treated by her dad. And this is all according to her. This is not me doing an armchair analysis. This is in her essay that she wrote about it. That like she, and it was her dad, and she also had an abusive relationship with her first husband, who was very abusive to her. And she views trans women as men who are predatorily infringing on women's territory and women's identities to co-opt sort of women's struggle and women's strife and the female experience. And Her actual problem that she has is with cisgender men. Two in particular. Her father and her ex-husband. Cisgender men who inflicted violence on her and who inflicted hardship on her, and she's taking that out on trans women. It's really fascinating how that works. So that's one aspect of it. So we're too deep in postulating survival. Maybe there's something baked in there evolutionarily, projection of personal trauma. And then I did get to I mentioned this next one, which I think is a big part of it, especially for bigotry toward queer people, which is religion. And we wouldn't be able to get through this conversation without talking about religion. And it's such a bummer that this has become such a big part of so many major world religions, not just Christianity, but it's become a part of so many major world religions, this idea that there is sort of this divinely consecrated and ordained order to gender and sex and sexuality. And if you go outside of that, you are an affront to the creator of the universe. And that is a very hard thing to deprogram. When someone literally believes in an all-knowing, omniscient, omnipotent creator, and they believe that that creator was intentional about creating men and women and having men and women procreate with each other and having men and women be in romantic partnership with each other and not men and men and not women and women, that's a really hard thing to deprogram. And it's frustratingly like one of the main things that keeps a lot of these religions from being useful, good, serviceable, charitable organizations. It's like so many of these organizations want to be a force for good in the world. So many churches want to be a force for peace and want to be a beacon of service and hope and light in the world. And they have these doctrinal things, these dogmatic beliefs that keep them from being able to be that way. And it's a bummer, especially when it comes to Christianity, because like if you talk to any Christian about like why, what, where in your religion does it say that you have to feel this way about queer people, they're always like, well, it's right there in the Bible. And then you just do that old walk them through it. Okay, where is it in the Bible? Oh, it's in the book of Leviticus. Okay, what else is in the book of Leviticus? I don't really know. Okay, well, let's walk through it. So, okay, what about like eating shellfish? What about wearing certain garments on certain days? What about having your beard on certain days and not having it on other days? What about, shunning women after their period and things like that? What about playing with the skin of a pig? What about all this stuff that you don't practice? And they'll say, oh, well, you know, the ones who actually are biblically literate and who have listened, who have paid attention in Sunday school will say, oh, well, I actually have an answer for that. You'll go, okay, tell me the answer. Why don't you practice all of those things from Levitican law? And they'll say, because when Christ came in human form to earth in the New Testament, he fulfilled Levitican law. And it's like every time I've had this conversation probably 40 or 50 different times with different Christians in my life. And every single time that we get to that point in the conversation, it's like I look at them and it's like that Ethan Klein moment where I'm like, so do you need me to connect the dots there? Can you do it yourself? Do you need me to fill in the blank there? Or do you got it? Have you finished the puzzle? So you don't practice all of those other things from Leviticus because Christ fulfilled Levitican law, making it null and void when he came to earth. And the only place in your book that you can point to saying that being gay is bad is there in that book. Do you need me to connect those dots for you? And that's the frustrating thing, is it's like, how have you not connected those dots? So it's really, really weird. I mean, first of all, it's just like, it's really bizarre to me to believe in a God that has all of these weird arbitrary rules in the first place. So many of the rules that were a part of Levitican law in the first place, it's like, what the hell is going on in there? Like what the omnipotent, omniscient creator of the universe who wants you to return to him in the afterlife and live in heaven with him forever has created a weird cosmic obstacle course where he's like, you can't have facial hair that looks like this. And if you do, you're going to hell. You can't wear this kind of garment. And if you do, like, it's like, what is happening? What is that? But like, I don't want to disparage anyone's personal beliefs, and I don't want to take away your right to believe the way that you want to believe, but it is so weird when I'm like, using your own beliefs, using the internal literary logic of the book that you're citing, this still doesn't make sense. Playing by your rules, this still doesn't make sense. So, like, help me out here. Help me out with this, because we're still stuck on this, and it's like the thing that's holding you back from being an actually good organization, and you don't even have doctrinal justification for it that makes sense using the internal logic of your thing. I'm not really sure about what it says in the Quran, or, you know, and I know that they've got their own beliefs on it too, but this is another one of those things where it's like, because humans had to create stories about what lightning was, you know, there were humans roving around in packs, in groups, and the sky would sometimes become gray and black, and there would be big bulbous shapes in the sky that would yell at them with a big crackling, like, growl, and then there would be big jagged bolts of power. There's not words for it. And I'm talking thousands of years. I'm talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago. People looking up in the sky and seeing big jagged lines of blue light that scream when they come out of a giant bulbous shape that has appeared in the sky. And you've got to figure out, like, what are we calling that? What is that? People used to think that tornadoes and the wind were like literal spirits, because what else would you call it? You look out into a field and there's like a cyclone of wind and air, and you can see it, and it's alive. It's got its own life force, and it's moving, and it's picking things up and throwing them, and it's making noise, and it's wreaking havoc. And it's like, what do you call that? Without any science, without any scientific foundation, without any understanding of like the fact that there are neurons hitting each other with friction up in the sky and creating electricity, without any understanding of that, what do you call that? And the result of it, the natural result of it, is like we have God myths. We have stories about like what the sun is and what the moon is and what the stars in the sky are and what the changing of the seasons mean. And, you know, like we create stories to explain it, because that's what humans are. We're storytellers. And because of that, all the way in the future, all the way today, when we actually have scientific explanations for all of those things, when we actually have practical, real-world understanding of all of those things, we've got to argue with a bunch of people who think that it's immoral to be gay, and they can't logically explain it to you. They can't logically explain to you, like, why it's fundamentally immoral or bad to be trans or gay, but they're just like, it just says so in my magic book. It says so in my thing. And it's like, well, yeah, and your thing exists because, like, people needed a lot of explanations for things that were really weird a long time ago. and it's succeeded and continued to progenerate across generations because it was a great framework for societies to control populations and for power structures to grow. And now we have that thing fueling bigotry. And it doesn't just fuel anti-LGBTQIA plus bigotry. It definitely is a big fueler in white supremacy as well, and in racism. Like, the Bible definitely definitely helps fuel white supremacy and white supremacist thought and the belief in sort of a white ethnocentric state, like a promised land, things that are the idea that there is some kind of lineage that you are a descendant of that is favored by God. These things are maybe among the most difficult to bake out of society when it comes to evaluating where bigotry comes from. So religion, yeah, religion's maybe one of the most key contributors to the problem of bigotry in our species. Another big one is just lack of comprehensive education. Obviously, just, you know, and we're seeing this right now that like the reason why education and educators are the enemy of the right is because education threatens conservative ideology. Conservative ideology is about promoting and maintaining the status quo, promoting and maintaining the current sociological power structures that exist, and education is harmful to those things. So education always has been the enemy to the status quo. It always, literally, what I was just talking about, people not understanding what lightning in the sky is, people not understanding what a tornado is, what a volcano is, and creating myths around that, stories that became the basis for societal oppression. These stories became the basis for bigotry and societal oppression. Education is the antidote to it. Education is the literal antidote to being like, oh no, we actually know what that is now. We actually know what that big cackling sound in the sky with the big jagged lines of light, we know what that is now, more or less. We have a better understanding of it now, and we don't need that oppressive myth story anymore. Education is the enemy to the status quo. It is always the thing that pushes us forward into a new era. So, you know, educating people on the actual statistics around like gender-affirming care and what it's doing to improve the quality of life for gender nonconforming people. Educating people is the solution, and it's the reason why people who are committed to their bigotry, people who are deep in the bigotry vortex, are deep in the space where they cannot and they probably won't ever in their lifetime admit to themselves or other people how much harm they're doing, they need to push back on education. They need to make sure that we're banning certain books in school systems. They need to make sure that we're not teaching critical race theory, because if we do, and if it threatens everything about the protected state that they're trying to not only keep society in, but themselves in, the state where they can continue being a martyr, the state where they can continue being the hero and the protagonist of their story. So teaching kids about institutional racism and how that works, this is not something that I was taught in school. The way that racism was taught to me in school was like, slavery happened, it was bad, we fought the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation happened, we freed the slaves, Abraham Lincoln, very good, what a great guy, and then everything was good for about 100 years, and then things got bad again in the 1960s, Martin Luther King gave a speech, and they fixed it, and it's all fixed now. And that's really more or less the narrative. That's really more or less the oversimplified, whitewashed narrative that was taught to preserve the feelings of white kids. This is the other thing that's so funny, is like this whole thing of like trying to protect our delicate white kids from the harsh realities of our racist past is not new. Everything that conservatives are doing right now in the culture war is rehashed territory. It's old. The reason why I was taught that shitty whitewashed narrative growing up is because they had already been on this trip of trying to protect my fragile white ego from having to know that people who looked like me created a society that was built to institutionally favor me and institutionally disadvantage people who don't look like me. It's already been going on. Anita Bryant's big thing back in the 1970s, 50 years ago, was that she doesn't hate gay people and she doesn't have a problem with people being gay. She's just trying to protect children. Her big thing was she's afraid of children being groomed by gay people. She said this over and over and over again. It's really about kids. It's not about hatred. I'm just trying to protect kids from being, you know, getting the wrong idea by seeing gay people out in public. I really think we need to protect our kids from this. So all this stuff that's happening right now with not wanting kids to be able to see drag queens or hear about anything gay at school, if their teacher's gay, you got to keep that quiet. You got to keep your lip zipped on that. All of this stuff is not new. It is well-worn, retreaded territory. Like it is, they're just recycling the same old bad arguments. So yeah, lack of comprehensive education. If we could teach kids about more than just the Civil Rights Act, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the, you know, just slavery, you know, the slave trade. If we could teach them about more than just, even though that's like, that should be enough right there to know that like the foundation of the country was the reason why so many black people exist in this country is they were brought over here to build the country with slave labor. But if we could teach them about, you know, putting Japanese people in internment camps, if we could teach them about the subjugation of Chinese rail workers and things like that, if we could teach them about redlining communities and the practice of, you know, even though there was equality under Jim Crow laws, the damage that segregation did, if we could teach them about the Tulsa massacre and stuff like, I didn't hear about the Tulsa massacre until I watched Watchmen on HBO like 2 years ago. It's the first time in my life that I ever heard about the Tulsa massacre. And it's like, that should be a major American historical event that is taught about, but it's not. So yeah, lack of education is definitely a big contributor to the pervasiveness of bigotry in our society. The last thing that I want to talk about, so that's sort of the rundown of things that came to my mind, and I'll turn it over to questions about if anyone has any things that I didn't say. Once again, the recap, the things that I postulated that might cause bigotry are some kind of survival mechanism, a fear of the other, you know, tribalism, trying to feeling like something is generationally baked into you to fear people who are culturally different, or whose identity differs from you in some way. That's the first thing. Projection of personal trauma, religion, lack of comprehensive education. So those are sort of the things that I came up with. There's probably more things. But what I was, a question that came up was, how do we know as people who want to oppose bigotry, how do we know that we are correct and that they are wrong? This is a problem that this is a problem that centrists have, and people who don't know where to stand in the culture war and in the culture debate, is like what they see is that J.K. Rowling is just as certain that she is right as Anita is and as I am, that I'm right. I literally had a guy in my comments the other day. I made a video where I was like debating Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck was saying something like, you know, we're mutilating kids with these surgeries, and we haven't even had a societal debate about the merits of whether or not we should be doing that. And it's like, that's just not true. We've been having this debate for a very, very, very long time. People have been presenting very coherent, cogent cases for gender-affirming care for quite some time, and people like Glenn Beck keep pretending to not hear it, keep pretending to not see it. But I made a video where I was responding to Glenn Beck and just kind of saying, like, dude, the debate has been had, the debate has been going on, and the debate has been won. Like, the debate is over. Like, your side, the side of bigotry, has lost. You have the weaker case. You have not demonstrated a case that is anywhere near as compelling as the case to just accept people for who they are. You have yet to demonstrate a compelling case for why we should try to further marginalize this historically disenfranchised and marginalized community. You have not presented an adequate case, but the case has been presented in many, many different ways adequately as to why we should embrace and accept and support gender nonconforming people. And this person in my comments of that video said, all I see here is two ideologies certain of themselves. You're just as certain that you're right as Glenn Beck is that he's right. Why would you think that you're any more correct than he is? And I think that that's a really common thing that people think when they're looking at this issue. Natalie talks about this in her video too. She talks about Megan Phelps Roper, who left the Westboro Baptist Church, which is like one of the most bigoted churches in the world. They're like one of the most vitriolically heinous, hateful churches in the entire world. And Megan Phelps Roper actually did a really commendable and laudable thing. She actually left that church and admitted that she had spent most of her life being like a heinous bigot. And that's a really tough thing. She pulled herself out of from deep, deep, deep in the bigot vortex. And it's very commendable. But Megan Phelps Roper sympathizes with J.K. Rowling because she feels like J.K. Rowling is getting a little bit too much backlash for her beliefs. She made an entire podcast called The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, where she basically put forth the idea that J.K. is the victim of a a witch trial. And Natalie points out that people like Megan, who come from a place where they were so certain they were right. So a person like me, for instance, who like I was raised in Mormonism and I was certain that I was correct about Mormonism. Megan was so certain that she was correct in her beliefs that she was yelling at people that they're going to hell, that soldiers were going to hell, that gay people were going to hell, and like holding signs outside of funerals saying you're burning in hell, like doing awful, heinous things. She was so certain of herself, only to realize that she was mistaken and that she was wrong, that she carries that skepticism into everything now. Going forward in her life, anytime she sees any group that is ideologically certain of its cause, she's very skeptical of it. And it's not that there's anything wrong with skepticism or with a healthy level of skepticism like that. It's just that, like, it's this question of like, how do we know that we're right and they're wrong? So she sees people like myself and people who are critical of J.K. Rowling and trans activists and things like that. And she's like, you're just as dug in, just as certain. And I've had friends. I just had lunch yesterday with a good friend from high school who one of his biggest problems with me and what I do on my channel is that I'm too confident. That I'm too confident that what I'm saying is like helpful and is right, and that I don't leave enough space for questions on a lot of this stuff. And I've told him before that I'm like, I don't have hardline stances on like legislation policies. I don't have hardline stances on like what the best, you know, tax policy would be, what the best system of healthcare would be. I don't have hardline, like, I definitely think there's room for debate on some of these things. I have hardline stances on human rights issues. I have hardline stances on debates over someone's validity as a human person, someone, whether or not a certain kind of person deserves basic human respect, basic human dignity, basic human rights. I have hardline stances on that kind of stuff. And those are the only things that I have hardline stances on, really. But this question always comes up of like, why do you think that you being so dug in on your ideology is any different from J.K. Rowling being dug in on hers? Because she is dug in and she's convinced, and she said many times in interviews, people go like, well, do you think you'll ever consider maybe walking back some of your statements? And she goes, the only thing that keeps me going, despite all the persecution, all the backlash, all of the people who are really mean to me now, is I know I'm right. And Anita Bryant said the exact same thing. The only thing that keeps me going is I know I'm right. I know I'm doing the right thing. So how do we know that we're more right than them? And I think it's a good question to ask. And I'm not sure that I'm going to actually be able to answer it definitively, but I think one kind of good test to come up with to maybe test this of like which side of an issue like this you should be on is asking yourself a sort of chicken and egg question of like, would my, let's call them oppositions. I have an opposition to transphobic people and to trans bigots and just to bigots of all kinds, to racist people and to white supremacists. I have an ideological opposition to that. Would my ideological opposition to those people exist if their ideological opposition to the marginalized people that they seek to oppress didn't exist? Hopefully the phrasing of that question made sense. So if you ask that both ways, so like, would I have an opposition to Christians, conservatives, people like this, if their opposition to queer people, people of color, you know, just like people who are not from the same country as them, if that didn't exist, would I still oppose them? Would I still think that they need to be defeated and that their ideas need to be defeated? And the answer to that question is no. My opposition to them would not exist without their bigotry. The only reason my ideological opposition to them exists in the first place, the only reason why I seek to oppose them and to defeat their ideas, is because their ideas exist. Now, if you ask that question in the inverse, would their ideological opposition to trans people, to people of color, would that exist if those people didn't oppose them? So if nobody on the other side opposed them, if we all were just going about our lives and we were just minding our own business and we never were showing up outside of J.K. Rowling's speaking events with picket signs, if we weren't there, if we weren't opposing her, would their bigotry still exist? And the answer is yes, because their opposition to these people is rooted, again, in fundamental aspects, immutable aspects of these people's identity. So whether trans people were trans activists and trans allies and advocates were loudly opposing J.K. Rowling or not, whether they were loudly shouting her down and calling her a bigot or not, she would continue to be a bigot. Nicholas Tim on YouTube says, "This is the dumbest argument I've ever heard." LOL. Yeah, I mean it's my best shot at it, you know. Because I'm trying to figure out, you know, how to draw the line between, and maybe it is a bad argument, because it's hard when you just see two people who are both dug in. My response to that guy on Instagram I thought was pretty good. The guy who said, the guy who was like, "All I see here is two different ideologies that are very certain of themselves." And I was like, yeah, you're kind of saying like, all I see here is one person who's really, really dug in on making sure that trans people don't die by suicide, and one group of people who's really, really dug in on eradicating trans people. So like, yeah, we're both really dug in on our causes. You're right. Like, you got us there. But like, my cause is preventing harm and preventing trans people self-harming or hating themselves or living in a world that is constantly reminding them that they are less than and othered. And the cause of the right is literal eradication. I am teacher Ale on TikTok just said, "We're not the same." Exactly. We're not the same. So when you break it down sort of when you put it in the abstract and say, you're both just two people who are ideologically certain of yourselves, it's like, yeah, I guess we're the same in that way, but our positions are not the same. And that's what I'm trying to do here with that argument of saying, like, my opposition to these people would not exist if they would just cool it. If they would stop with their hatred, if they would stop with their bigotry, if they would stop with their mission to oppress and eradicate everyone that they disagree with fundamentally on basis of just like who they are as a person, just fundamental aspects of their identity, if they would stop doing that, then I wouldn't have a problem with them anymore. My problem wouldn't exist. My ideological opposition wouldn't exist. However, if I were to decide tomorrow that I'm done ideologically opposing these people, and if everyone who protests them, who pickets them, who calls them bigots, who shouts them down, if everyone stopped tomorrow, they would continue being bigots. They would continue their mission. And it's because in the chicken and egg scenario, their thing comes first. Their hatred is the reason for our opposition. Without their hatred, we have nothing to oppose. But their hatred exists independent of whether or not we are opposing them. It's there, regardless of whether we're opposing it. So that's what I'm trying to do with that argument, Nicholas Tim on YouTube, is just like illustrate how these two things are not the same. And how kind of give you a litmus test for how you can try to determine whether you're on the right ideological side of something. Is like, okay, I really feel strongly about this thing. That person really feels strongly about this thing. How can we figure out who's right? Well, the only reason why I have an opposition to them is because what they're doing is actively harmful and detrimental to marginalized people. If they weren't doing that, I would have no problem with them. But their thing is like, I'm going to do it whether you oppose me or not. My goal is to eradicate this marginalized group of people, is to further oppress them, to further impose my will onto them. So there is an aggressor, and there is a group of people who are the aggressors in this situation, and there's a group of people who are opposing the aggression, pushing back on the aggression, trying to defeat the aggressors, you know? I don't know if that makes, I actually don't know if that works as the definitive way to determine who's right, who's wrong. I don't know. Fern Lovebond says they see themselves as protecting themselves from us as much as I feel I need protection from them. I understand that. I get that. But again, that's sort of an abstraction. Because yeah, J.K. Rowling will cherry pick examples of people who have written really vitriolic things on protest signs or people who have DM'd her with really mean things. And she'll say like, see, these people are really violent. And I get that. In the abstract, they see themselves as being just as preyed upon by us as we are by them. But again, I'm like, it's sort of like a bully at school who just is constantly picking on some little kid who can't really defend himself, you know, and finally someone else stands up for that little kid and like gets in the bully's face and punches that bully in the nose and breaks his nose. And then that bully's like, you broke my nose, and goes and runs to the teacher and is like, they punched me in the nose. And then someone comes into the situation and goes, look, that kid is just as justified to be afraid of you for punching him in the nose as you are to be afraid of him. If anything, he's more justified. You were really mean to him. And they're completely ignoring the fact that, like, he wouldn't have gotten punched in the nose if he hadn't started the shit in the first place. It's a chicken and egg thing, you know? And Fern wants me to read this extra comment here on YouTube. This is why they mislabel us as various degraded statuses. They say pedo or groomer. They call us hateful and find exceptions where bad things are done by our peers because it inverts the aggression. Exactly. And that's, you know, this goes all the way back to the start of the video of why Matt Walsh needs to be such a liar about intra-racial violence and interracial violence. The reason why he needs to be so disingenuous is because he is the aggressor of racial violence in the country. He is the purveyor of white supremacy. He is on that team that is creating racial disharmony and creating those problems. And so what he needs to do is craft arguments that disingenuously make it seem like both sides are the aggressors. And so, yeah, you could technically say like, it is aggressive. It is just as aggressive to punch a bully in the nose, to punch Richard Spencer in the jaw. But the thing is Richard Spencer doesn't get punched in the jaw if Richard Spencer isn't a Nazi. Richard Spencer being a Nazi comes first. That is the first thing. And it can't be ignored. You can't just abstract the situation and go, well, I see Richard Spencer kind of saying some of these things that seem kind of aggressive towards this group of people, but I also see him getting punched by people who oppose him. So like, but he doesn't get punched if he doesn't do the thing. He does the thing whether he gets punched or not. The punch doesn't inform him doing the thing. The punch doesn't inform Richard Spencer being a Nazi. Richard Spencer is a Nazi whether he gets punched or not. He only gets punched because he's a Nazi. The bully on the playground is going to be a bully whether you punch him in the nose or not. He's going to be doing his thing, bullying, regardless. He's only going to get punched in the nose if some kid decides they've had enough as a result of what he's already been doing. So yeah, this whole thing of like, well, you're both the same. You're both just ideologically dug in. And it's like, yeah, I'm ideologically dug in on the idea that like no one should be run out of town, deprived of their rights, deprived of basic human dignity, basic human respect because of an immutable fact of their birth. I'm really dug in on that. And the people I oppose are really dug in that like, nah, I don't want to view those people as human. So yeah, we're both really dug in. But like, if you can get intellectually honest about what we're both dug in on and about whose thing exists independent of the other person's thing, I think you can really start to parse that out. Real Estate Jack B says, wild that we talk about Glenn Beck, Matt Walsh, and J.K. Rowling as though they are the same. They are. They're all different shades of the same thing, but they are. They're all on the same team. The funny thing about J.K. Rowling is she likes to think of herself, and this is, and again, Natalie Wynn covers this brilliantly in her video. People like J.K. Rowling like to think of themselves as an example of how there is bipartisan criticism of trans people, that like people on the left and people on the right criticize trans people. People on the right criticize trans people because they think that gender nonconformity is a sin against God. It's an aberration of the divine form. And people on the left criticize trans people because they think that it's a co-opting of feminism and a co-opting of the feminine experience, and that these are both valid positions, but like really, it's just two people who are refusing to accept trans people as valid people. It's just two people who are refusing to accept that trans women are women and trans men are men. They have the same position. They like to disingenuously convince themselves that they're coming from a different place. J.K. Rowling convinces herself that she's on the left, that she's a feminist fighting for feminist causes against a misogynistic cause of men pretending to be women. She convinces herself of that so that she can retain her status as the hero protagonist of her story. But it's not true. Her cause is not feminist. Her cause is literally telling a certain kind of woman, you are not a valid kind of woman. You're not a valid kind of woman because you haven't had all of the experiences that I've had. Even though that's such a flimsy argument, it's like, well, no woman has had the experiences that any other woman has had in entirety. Women, the experience of being a woman is not a monolithic thing. It is not just, it's this and nothing else. When women talk about Dylan Mulvaney, cisgender women talk about Dylan Mulvaney not being able to have the experience of going through puberty as a woman, it's like, well, you don't have the experience of going through puberty as a trans woman. You don't have the experience of growing up and growing into a body that doesn't match your internal feeling of your identity. So, using that logic of you have to have my experience in order to be a real woman, Dylan Mulvaney could say the same thing to you. Dylan Mulvaney could say like, oh, well, since you don't actually have the lived experience of a trans woman, you're not a real woman. And they're like, well, you're diminishing what woman means. No, that's why the word cisgender and trans exist. It's like saying that like a 7 foot tall woman doesn't really know what it's like to be a woman because most women are short. Most women are under 6 feet tall, so any woman that's over 6 feet tall doesn't really understand the experience of women who go through life between 5 feet and 5'6". You tall women, you're out here living a guy's experience. You can't relate to the women down here. It's like, no, I'm just a tall woman. That's just an adjective. It's just one aspect of my identity as a woman and my lived experience as a woman. Being a transgender woman, that's just an aspect of my identity as a woman that colors the kind of experience that I have in the world as a woman. That's the kind of experience as a woman that I had, was as a transgender woman. I had to go through that experience. And it's a different experience than cisgender women will experience. But it's still an experience of womanhood. So Matt Walsh, Glenn Beck, J.K. Rowling might like to position themselves at different places along the gradient. But it's also further evidence that like, they don't want anything to do with each other. You see this all the time on the right where they're like, oh, no, I'm not like him. Like Glenn Beck would be like, oh no, Matt Walsh is too extreme for me. I'm not like him, you know? And Matt Walsh might be like, J.K. Rowling, I'm nothing like her. No, like, no, you know, but it's like they have the same position. They all come down on the same area of not wanting to grant trans people essential personhood. If that makes sense. Yeah, Carly on YouTube just said, my not having children mustn't make me a woman. Snap. Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, there's all these different things, you know, when J.K. Rowling's asked what a woman is, she likes to say like, women are the producers of the large gametes and things like that, and get into all these anatomical things and biological things. And it's just like, so what about like people who are assigned female at birth, who live their life as a woman, who are born with intersex organs, who like they have organs that don't produce that, or like they were only born with one ovary. They're born without the ability to menstruate. They're born without the ability to become pregnant, but they live life and experience life in the social identity of a woman. Like any one of these little things you can try to do to be like, no, this is what it means to be a woman, is like, it breaks down the second that you get intellectually honest about actual human biology. And again, we go back to education, because a lot of people just aren't aware that there are more than two ways that your body can be oriented anatomically, and that there are lots of people who are living the social experience, the social experience of a man or a woman, who are being socially identified as a man or a woman, who actually internally have intersex anatomies. The very existence of these people, the factual existence of these people, shreds this whole idea that there's two things. There's men and women, and anyone who says they're anything else is a liar. So Posey Parker, who I mentioned earlier, not Parker Posey, Posey Parker loves to say that trans people literally don't exist, that there's no such thing, that there's no such thing as a non-binary person, there's no such thing as a trans person, they're all just mentally ill people who are lying about their identity. But she's factually, scientifically wrong. She literally thinks that the only two things that exist factually, scientifically, are men and women, and that's it. And everyone else is in some sort of weird space where they're either lying or they're mentally ill. But she's literally looking reality in the face. She's seeing that, like, trans people exist. You can see them. You can talk to them. Non-binary people exist. She knows, she must know on some level that intersex people exist, that babies are born with anatomical sex characteristics of both traditional genders. And she must know that. And if she doesn't, that's a failure of education. That's just a failure of comprehensive education on the topic, you know? So anyone that tells you there's just two things, it's like, well, either you're being knowingly disingenuous, either you're knowingly ignoring and leaving out the existence of intersex people, or you're not aware of the existence of intersex people. And either way, you're not right. I had a line in my most recent We're Not the Same video where the Republican character says, well, and it's about intersex babies and about how people will do surgeries on intersex babies' sex organs to make them appear more clearly identifiable as male or female. And the conservative character says, well, I'm not aware of that, and I don't believe in things that I'm not aware of as a rule. And sometimes that's how it feels when you're arguing with these people about this thing, is it's like, you not being aware that there are more than two anatomical ways that people present, just factually, you not being aware of that is not a valid argument. You not being aware of that doesn't mean it's any less true, you know? So Ask Mama J says, 1 in 1,000 babies are born with ambiguous genitalia. That's actually a lot. I don't know if you were intending to make it sound like not a lot, but it's actually a lot. It's actually, if it is 1 in 1,000, that's a lot. That's like quite common. If that is the actual number, I don't know. I'd have to fact check it. But even if it was 1 in 1,000,000, and you know, people, sometimes conservatives will argue from a place where they'll say like, well, it's such a small amount of people that it's statistically irrelevant. But it's still like, yeah, but you still can't say that it's not real. You can't say that the only thing that exists is men and women, even if it's 1 in 1,000,000 that are born with ambiguous genitalia. You still can't say that. It's kind of like Matt Walsh saying that it literally doesn't exist, that white on black crime and white on black violence literally doesn't exist. It's like, even if you wanted to be a little more, even if you wanted to say like, even if Matt Walsh wanted to say like, well, no, what I mean is it happens so rarely that it's basically never. It's like, yeah, but that's not what you said. You said literally never. You said literally, it literally always goes one way. So if you're going to have the conversation in that disingenuous way, I really wish I could get conservatives to understand that if you have to be disingenuous about your argument, you're not making a good argument. It's so weird how many of them don't understand that. That it's like you're not arguing in good faith. Now, I'd never heard of this. Natalie talks about it in the video. I'd never heard of the term Mott and Bailey. I don't know if you've heard of this, Mott and Bailey arguments, but it's so much of what conservatives do when arguing in this space, especially on gender and things like this, is Mott and Bailey argue. A Mott and Bailey argument is you have a castle that's surrounded by a Mott, and it's very easy to defend, and it's very well reinforced, and then you have a little town down the way that is more poorly defended and harder to defend, and people will make their bad argument that's hard to defend, and then when you call them out on what a bad argument they're making, they will retreat to the castle with the Mott and say that they're arguing something else. So J.K. Rowling does this all the time. She will argue that trans women aren't valid and that trans women aren't women and that they're just men pretending to be women. And like, when you start taking her to task about, like, you know, because she'll use all these things like biological reality and producers of the large gametes and all this stuff. And when you start taking her to task about anatomical facts and about the existence of intersex people and about how this all could be tied into the gender spectrum and about just like how we've known about trans people throughout human history and how they've always existed. When you start taking to task her poorly defended argument about trans women aren't women, trans people aren't valid, she retreats to her Mott position, the castle, where she says, what I'm really concerned with is men pretending to be trans to sexually assault women. So what you're disagreeing with is the sexual assault of women. Like, I'm trying to protect women from being sexually assaulted by men pretending to be trans women. So cisgender men saying that they're trans, going into a changing room and sexually assaulting women. That's what I'm actually trying to do. And you're disagreeing with that. And it's like, no one disagrees that sexual assault is bad. You're being disingenuous. And it's so weird that a person with J.K. Rowling's pedigree and education wouldn't understand that doing that, that having to do that, having to retreat to a disingenuous bad faith argument, means that her argument is weak, means that she's not making a strong argument. And they do this all the time. They do this over and over and over again. Well, they'll say some inflammatory thing. All trans people, all non-binary people, all gender non-conforming people are mentally ill. They're suffering from mental illness, and we shouldn't suffer people's mental illnesses or indulge their delusions about their identity. They'll say something really heinous and bigoted like that, and you'll go, that's a really heinous, bigoted thing, and it's just not supported by like any psychologists or healthcare professionals that actually work with these people. That's just not what this is. That's not what's going on here. They'll retreat back to some position that's completely different than that. They'll be like, well, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that, like, I feel like it's a little unfair for girls to have to compete against like biological boys in sports, you know? They'll retreat to something that maybe feels like they can defend it a little bit easier. Yeah. Lil Faye Mama on TikTok says, between different genome and hormone pairing, there are hundreds of ways one can present biologically. Totally. Yeah, totally. Are you referring to a mote? It is Mott, though. M-O-T-T-E. Not a mote. A Mott. I wonder if Mott is like a different word for mote, but it's not a mote. A mote is water around a building, but the Mott is like the fortress. It's a, I don't know. You can look it up. Watch the video by Natalie. It's great. Carly on YouTube says, honestly, these one in whatever, you know, one in a million, one in a thousand, one in 10,000, these one in whatever stats just make the variance in human biology seem pretty poetic for us to have such variance. I agree. I think what we should be doing as a society is viewing gender nonconforming people as like the answer. They're the answer to like patriarchy and harmful gender norms and the harmful beliefs about gender that have been plaguing us for so long. They're the answer. That's what's so frustrating is like Anita Bryant and J.K. Rowling's problem is with their fathers and with men that have treated the cisgender men that have treated them poorly. And those men's problem, the men that treated them poorly, their problem was patriarchy. It's the way that patriarchy and the current societal gender hierarchy hurts everyone. That gender roles are just as harmful to men as they are to women. That like it's not good for anybody. And the answer, the solution is these people who show us that it is fluid, that it's a spectrum, that we do not need to structure our society in this archaic way. Again, education being the antidote, that like we no longer need to structure our society in a way where we give we build societal power in for men because men are the ones who provide the hunt, who go on and get the food. That's not the way society works anymore. It's no longer necessary for us to cling to these outdated ideas. We are learning new things about how gender and gender roles and sexuality and sex work. And people who are gay, people who are bisexual, pansexual, trans, non-binary, they show us so much more about who we can be and how we can function. And they show us a way into the future that's more compassionate and that's more open, where we're seeing people as individuals and seeing people as this beautiful, poetic thing rather than just like you fit in this box and therefore you do this thing in society. They are the answer, the way forward, the antidote, the healing thing to what J.K. Rowling experienced with her abusive relationship with her father, with her abusive relationship with her ex-partner. The things that fueled that abuse are things like patriarchy and things like oppressive, outdated societal ideas and norms around gender and sex and sexuality. And the antidote to that is the very thing that she's fighting against, sadly. Anyway, I think I'm going to call it there. It's been a long episode. I think that's a good place to call it. A lot more that we could talk about on that topic, but thanks for being here. Thank you for all the comments, everybody. Thank you for keeping the discussion lively over on TikTok and here on YouTube. We had a nice audience over here on TikTok tonight. This was great. Thank you so much. This was really, really nice. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. You can look me up on Spotify, Apple Music. All my music is there. Patreon.com/Austin Archer if you want to support this channel, if you want to support this show. We would love to have you over there. Honestly, the Patreon patrons sometimes, some months, are the only thing keeping the lights on. So Patreon patrons, shout out to you. Thank you so much. And if you have the expendable income, if you have the available bandwidth, I would really, really love your support over there. Patreon.com/Austin Archer. You can go to the link in my bio, get yourself a Nobody Cool Likes Tucker Carlson shirt if you want one, or, order any of the stuff that I have for sale there. Yeah, lots of ways that you can support, or you can just be here. You can just be here watching, commenting. That also works. Follow me on YouTube, Austin Archer on YouTube. Subscribe and get all the updates there. All right. Okay. That's it. Love you so much. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.